Hi, I'm Ben.
I am Zach.
Welcome to the Movie Vault. Today, we're going to take you back in time, and we're going to review an all-time classic. What would that all-time classic be, Zach?
Citizen Kane from 1941, Orson Welles' brain, splattered out into a black and white film with great acting, subpar makeup, but also a pretty good storyline overall.
Yes.
But yes. This is the movie that everyone brags about. This is the movie that everyone has said is the greatest movie of all time.
It's either this or The Godfather, which we already did. So it's now it's they're head to head. Ding, ding, ding.
We are going to see who will win because we have just recently watched it as of 5 minutes ago.
And so it's fresh.
It is very fresh. So Orson Welles is the director. What else is he known for besides just this? Do you know?
War of the Worlds radio drama.
Oh,
that was the one where it came out on the radio and people actually thought that there was aliens attacking Earth. That's the Orson Welles stories I always remember the most.
Okay, interesting.
And so he was big into radio dramas. And this was like, I think, if I'm reading correctly, this was his first like movie or motion picture, whatever you'd like to call it. And so I don't think it was necessarily a guarantee that this was going to be a success, and in fact I don't think that this movie was all that successful when it originally came out, which is always interesting when that happens.
Interesting. So he also has done a couple other things, such as The Third Man, right?
He was in The Third Man.
He was in it. Okay, so he plays the main character.
Let me see what other he in The Third Man. He is not the main character, but he is an important role.
Gotcha.
Of the movie.
Well, either way, he's pretty good in this movie. So, Ben, just for starting off, do you think it is the best movie ever made, as everybody asserts?
I don't know that you could ever... This is such a cop-out answer. I don't know that you could ever determine a best movie ever made. So, and on first watch, I'm not sure I'm ready to call it the best movie ever made. But I will say this. I think I would give this a 5 out of 5.
Really?
Yeah. On my immediate gut reaction, which I usually trust.
So, well, then what stuck out to give it a 5 out of 5? I don't get that.
I think there's something sort of grandiose about the whole thing. And I love the way that it used, it just framed the story. So instead of it just being like a straightforward story about a guy who built a fortune and then lost it all. Like, you could make this a linear storyline, right? Where you just have, you show the beginning scene with his mother and it just keeps building and building. You show all of his relationships. You don't need all of this, like people interviewing other people and all of that. But I think that the way they framed it by showing how each person who was close to him interacted with him and how the effect that he had on their life and the effect that they had on his life was actually a much more interesting and compelling way to show the story. So that would be the first thing I think that really stuck out to me about this movie.
Yeah, I think one thing though is like the best movies all have there's two sides of it. One, there is a great moral, great story going on, interesting, brand new, unique, and visually cool, and the acting is great. You know, that's all kind of like the main cinematic experience. Plus, you have the world building and the way that the movie actually flows, the style, the direction, what scenes, the cuts, the camera angles, and the lighting and everything. So I think there's like a finesse to it in this, particularly that I think you mentioned this right after the movie, like it didn't feel like it was made in 1940. It was released in 1941. It felt like there was some humor that could have been used, you know, in movies today. So it is interesting to see like the style of movies compared to other older movies that we've seen, because it's been, what, 80 years now?
Yeah. This is the oldest movie we've reviewed on this podcast, right?
Well, Dr. Strangelove was like 60s or 70s?
60s. So we even skipped the 50s, went into the 40s when this movie was made. And I wish that I was more of an expert on older Hollywood things, but I'm really not. I know some of the like, well, there's silent films in the 1920s that were popular. There were some German ones that now get referenced as being big. Silent film would still go on into the 30s with like Charlie Chaplin. But there was plenty of other. Alfred Hitchcock started in the 1930s and other people. And they started like making like Hollywood as we know it today. But this kind of feels like I saw it might be controversial because I saw this was like like somebody that, you know, when they talk about auteur theory, like the director is the one who's the driving force behind what makes the movie great. That's kind of, I don't know that it started with this movie, but this movie is like a early version of that, where people would say it's Orson Welles's movie and it's his vision cast. And I guess it's even kind of a second level because he's the main actor in it too. So I think you can, it was definitely significant, but it's interesting that it wasn't like recognized in its time, like immediately. Hmm. But are all great movies immediately, or are all great pieces of art immediately recognized?
No.
So
definitely not.
And it said, let's see here in Wikipedia, trustworthy source we know. I think it says that it was during the 1950s that people started to, there was a re-release of the movie and people started to like gravitate back towards it, and it started to build its case to be the greatest movie ever.
Hmm. Only 10 years later. That's a lot less than I thought for the greatest movie ever.
I think it was more like 15 years. It says André Bazin, who is a renowned and influential French film critic and film theorist, who I wonder whether he was involved in sort of the French New Wave, which if he was, or even if he wasn't, the French New Wave is sort of the another like important moment in auteur cinema, because all of those directors from that time period, it was all about what's Jean-Luc Godard going to make, what's François Truffaut going to make, what's Louis Malle, I think, going to make. So and it was, and now, you know, as film fans, you start to, now you kind of categorize everything as like, oh, this director made these films and this director made these films. But if you go back to films in the 30s and 40s, you're going to be like, who are these guys? Because nobody talks about the guy who directed White Christmas, or the guy, maybe some people do, or the guy who directed, even the guy who directed Casablanca, I'm not sure whether he's super well known. Somebody could probably correct me on that. But it was more about the stars and the celebrity carrying the film.
Yeah, and this is a character story. It's about, you know, Charles Foster Kane, and what is his dying word? What does Rosebud mean? That's the thesis of the movie. What could it possibly mean? I think you get hints of it at the beginning. You do get to see some of the sled and everything. So you do get, I don't know if you get to explicitly see the words at the beginning of the movie. Rosebud?
If you do, it's very unnoticeable, and it goes over your head. At least for me, it did.
But it shows the rise and the fall of a complex, complicated man who's searching for something in life that he never really finds. He's married and divorced twice, has a kid, isn't really involved after that, has the rise of an empire and the fall of an empire pretty quickly, and a mental breakdown at the end before saying uttering his last dying words, you know, Rosebud. So, what kind of things in the themes of this movie, what themes of this movie stuck out the most? For me, I think the theme of self-destruction and the symbols of it. You know, you had all these weird, the scenes that were the most chaotic were the ones where he was just going crazy in general. You know, I remember one clip in general, or specifically, where it was after the affair, and after he, you know, everybody knew about the affair, and then there was like this bird that came on the screen. It was like just squawking, and it had nothing to do with the story. Yeah. And it was just like a quick clip of a bird, and then it goes like the scene's right behind the bird. And I was like, I kind of got a little scared, maybe. I don't know, maybe. But it was just kind of like shockingly. And I was like, why would they put that in there? And I started to think, like, maybe they put it in there to show, like, you know, this is kind of like, I don't know, it's just showing us like what this self-destruction looks like. Because then in the very next scene, he goes in and his wife's leaving, and then he's, you know, destroys the entire room. When he was at the top, he was like the richest. He had the castle, he had the manor, he had you know, all these newspaper businesses and everything. So it's I think it's a metaphor in some way. And then also, like, it was the scene before, it was like his wife doing the opera stuff, so maybe it was like, yeah, symbolizing that as well, you know, how bad she was.
Yeah. Yeah, the squawk.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. So there are a couple things that are really open to interpretation, and that's kind of, I feel like this movie was early in that process of what is, you know, what could we make this movie about, you know, let's have the audience determine what that means. So it's really just a foot in the door for postmodern filmmaking. But yeah, I think the themes of self-destruction and just searching for something that you're not really going to find, that's what I kind of took away from it, as the sad, lonely man dies alone.
Yeah. I think this movie is easily relatable to our time as well, because it sort of sets up this expectation for like the moral billionaire, I guess. I mean, he wasn't probably a billionaire, but he was. I think everyone has this idea that like if you had a lot of money, you would just be able to do so much good with it. And you kind of see like the complexity of the reality of the situation of what occurs when you do have access to a lot of money, because it seems like at the start of his career, Orson Welles is endeavoring to do a lot of things that he thinks are good and moral, but by the end of his life, you realize that it's that he did everything for himself, and you maybe start to doubt a little bit the human capacity to even actually do anything that isn't just self-serving, at least in their own merit, like, which is what he was trying to do. Because I think in his head, he was doing people a lot of good for most of his life, and sometimes he would be self-aware and be like, well, this is how it is, or whatever. But really, when it came down to it, he was going to do it his way, or it wasn't going to be done at all. So I think nowadays people will kind of complain of the same thing of people who they feel like are in his position. But the question is, and I think Charles Foster Kane, I was trying to remember his middle name. He asked the same question the other way, like, would he have been a better person if he had less money? Mm-hmm. And some people ask the question, would I be a better person with more money than this person who has a lot of money? But it doesn't appear that that would be the case, because money doesn't change anything about you. It just gives you more access to things. So how you are when you don't have a lot of money isn't necessarily going to change just because you have a ton of money, which is there's a lot of people who think that gaining a lot of wealth will somehow change how you actually are as a person. It'll certainly change, yeah, like I said, what you have access to, what your daily life looks like, and a lot of other things. But does that change the center of who you are as a person?
Yeah, that is true. It's, you know, it's not the, it's just about the person in general. The line was, if I hadn't been very rich, I might have been a good man. That's a good line. So good I wrote it down, so I'm glad you noticed that too. It makes me feel good that I can identify those things. But the, you know, the whole part of the movie about the rosebud, you know, it really does go back to, who is this boy? Who is this man? Why is he so mysterious? Why are people looking into his life after he dies? Why is it so important that they know what rosebud means? It's because this man is complicated. People don't understand him. They don't know why he did what he did. So maybe this rosebud will answer it. And, you know, the audience gets to know, but the characters do not. So the fact that this sled, this thing that was used as a weapon against him at the beginning of the movie, is now this thing of maybe comfort, or looking back on his childhood to his mother, you know, the life that could have been before all of this happened. This is more of like a reluctant thing that a reluctant rich person, you know, he doesn't want to be rich. He doesn't want to be put in these situations. In fact, he didn't want to do all those philanthropic endeavors that, like, he didn't want to go down the usual path for that. He wanted to make his own newspaper business. Yeah. He was doing all these things that weren't necessarily normal for a billionaire or millionaire at the time, whatever, inflation. But once he was taken away from his mother, you know, he thinks of Rosebud as this, either as this source of safety, or he's looking back at before he was taken away, you know, because that was, as soon as he was hit with that sled, everything changed forever, you know, technically. Like, that's the changing point. So I think that's what it might mean. I bet there's so many other theories out there as well.
Right.
What do you think?
Yeah, I think that is probably what the meaning of Rosebud is. Because, I mean, he's just a kid. There's no way he understands what it means to, or the reason why his parents, we don't even really fully understand the reason why his parents decided to send him. It appears that, I mean, there was some hinting to the fact that his mom might have thought that his dad was abusive towards him, because there's that last line at the end. At first you think the mom's kind of like cold and doesn't like her son, but then you see her say something like, well, he doesn't have to be with you anymore. Like, as he says something about, we need to give him a good thrashing, which that's kind of interesting. It doesn't necessarily answer any questions, but it does maybe provide some more context to the situation. But sending him with some unknown banker to raise him also, I'm not sure that necessarily seems like a great decision, especially somebody as sort of pragmatic and cold-hearted as Thatcher, I believe what his name was. But and then just deciding, I think they're just like, we're just going to give all this money to him when he's 25. Like, and that's going to happen. And basically, that's kind of, I mean, you're 25 and you didn't do anything for it. That's kind of a burden, because there's like Thatcher references as he gives over the money, like that there's like some sort of expectation with that. A lot of 25-year-olds aren't necessarily looking for like an expectation of them that's that deep at that time, which probably leads to some of his antics and weird decision making as he tries to establish himself in his own way and not in the way that other people are trying to tell him to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think the answer we got was this man is lonely. He's, you know, he's empty. He has this giant mansion on the top of this, you know,
it's
mountain.
It's literally a palace.
He's trying to fill it with things, you know. Yeah. Same. That's representative of the way that he's trying to fill his life with, you know, things where it's just immeasurable. You can't fill it up. That's why he has all these empty rooms, but and he has these guests over that he'll never even see because they're so far away. He's in the same place.
Don't you remember the guests? No, they're never.
Yeah, it's a palace. You don't see them. But and then it has these shots of all these piles of things just going throughout this big corridor. And I think it does symbolize like just this man is so broken and so empty that he's trying to fill it with all these other life endeavors and maybe a wife, you know, super submissive, by the way, just like not just in a way like just in. Demanding and not even listening to her concerns and just ignoring her, slapping her, stuff like that. So
two,
you know,
wives, one who is more of a political wedded marriage, and one that was a like business marriage, almost like you were saying.
Yeah, transactional. It's not.
Yeah,
it is
transactional.
He's not looking for anything. You know, he's looking for someone to love him. He's not looking for something to love. So I think you have all these cool cinematographic, how do you say that? Cinematic, you could say maybe.
Yeah, I guess cinematic.
Whatever. But shots of like the big mountain, you know, it's obviously fake, but like you can look at it and be like, okay, that's huge. And then it's like this big room and there's a shot where the woman's doing the puzzle, right? And his second wife, and he's sitting in a chair super far away and the shot like shows him in the background. It's just like, that shows how distant they are, really. Like, they're so far away, and he's like, I think I'm going to go for a picnic. He's saying it, like, 30 yards away from her.
She's like, say it louder.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
But I think there's a lot of shots that symbolize that, at least a couple things that I noticed, you know. And then also, like, you know, he says they relate the jigsaw puzzles that she did to his life. And I think they threw away that puzzle piece, you know, the sled. Maybe a couple other things would have been needed to figure out this man is just broken and lonely. Obviously, the butler kind of knew that after the tantrum that he threw, but there were a lot of hints towards it that other people from the outside might not have saw. But it's great. I mean, the character just going so deep into the character, just showing like all these different views on him. You know, good views, bad views, mainly bad views. Like all these different areas. Like his life was very inconsistent, right? He starts off in philanthropy, and then the newspaper business and the opera business. He's going through all these phases to try to search for something, and you see he never finds it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now I'm getting on some rabbit holes. I liked one thing that the critic David Thompson said about this movie. He said that the film grew... Well, he said this in like the 1960s. So he said, the film grows with every year as America comes to resemble it. And I think that's pretty... a pretty interesting point, because I think in some ways this movie, I don't know whether it reflected how America was at the time, because America was about to go into a war and had just come out of, or was coming out of the Great Depression, which was a period of not a lot, like not having a lot. So one of the things I wonder is maybe if audiences couldn't really relate to like the fact that this guy had so much stuff, or because you weren't even thinking about having a lot of stuff, because it was so scarce for anybody to be successful at the time. Even successful people imploded after the night. People who people would have thought were successful imploded after the 1920s and were poor again. So this thought of, I'm sure they were still the very wealthy, they certainly were still there, but it wasn't as much in people's direct mind. Whereas as they came out of the U.S. came out of the war in the 50s and 60s, materialism rose exponentially after those points because of the period of time, the post-war period where the economy exploded, and it was just easier for more people. Certainly there's still a subset of people who weren't wealthy, but there was a lot more people moving into the middle class and the upper middle class than there had been. And so I don't know why that made the movie more popular, as it is kind of portraying the lonelinesses of the pursuit of wealth, or not even just the pursuit of wealth, because a lot of points were made that Charles Foster Kane did things to, he wasn't just out to make money, but he was certainly out to gain, he was out to gain love, but his way of getting love was to use his money to buy it and be transactional about it. And that sort of goes back to the idea that money can solve all your problems. Cause if you don't have a lot of money, who's going to love you? But if you have a lot of money, there's a lot of people who want to love you. That's mm-hmm. sort of the
gold diggers.
That's sort of the underlying belief that, consciously or subconsciously some people have, like the thing that they're missing out on, or why they're not gaining attention or popularity is their lack of wealth and having wealth. I think especially males can fall into this trap.
Why do you say that?
The way that men tend to think about things is that like your status is defined by wealth.
Okay.
It is a generalization. I'm sure women can also think the same way. Okay. And but Charles Foster Kane being an example of this, like,
sure. yeah,
and you see that it doesn't really end up working out for him, because the women in his life don't really end up wanting stuff, although they might have initially been enamored by it, but they kind of realize that this stuff doesn't really mean anything.
Sure. Yeah, there's a good line by the character Jerry Thompson. You know, Mr. Kane is a man who got everything he wanted, then lost it. Maybe Rosebud was something he couldn't get, or something he lost. Anyway, it wouldn't have explained anything. I don't think any word can explain a man's life. No, I guess Rosebud is just a piece in a jigsaw puzzle, a missing piece. And, you know, the irony is that, obviously, they burn it at the end. So it's left to Kane's mind, and it's lost forever. So, yeah, that's what I think it is. You know, what can a man have, you know? He has a man who has everything. What could he want? What else could he want? What could you gift to a man who has everything? That's like a phrase, yeah. Something like that. But yeah, and the only thing you can give him is something that he lost, maybe. So, and that would be, you know, his childhood, the other life that he could have had without this burden of wealth, possibly. So yeah, like you said, you know, money, people say money can't buy happiness. He was trying to make it work, but I think deep down he knew it wouldn't work. I think he was just trying to, I don't know.
He was trying to ignore the reality, perhaps.
Yeah.
That he, and believe that he could do. And he was really stubborn. I mean, you could really see the self-centeredness in a lot of parts of the movies. He wasn't willing to listen to criticism.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and so and that was his biggest flaw. It was that he wouldn't adapt to when other people called him out about stuff, he would just see it as an attack and he wouldn't listen to them.
Yeah.
And so he couldn't grow because he would never listen to any criticism.
It also seemed like he was pretty self-centered since the beginning. I don't think it really developed. He kind of just, like, even at the parties that they threw at the beginning, everybody was just singing for him and cheering for him, and he was just like a-okay with it. He loved it. It was great. Even when he's like younger and like 25, when he got his inheritance or whatever, it was like he's not listening to any of the elder advisors that he has, which is okay. You know, maybe he's right, but he's not very respectful to them either. He's just doing his own thing without even considering. So I think that's just how he was always been. But I think over time he got more and more and more cynical, and less happy as time went on.
Yeah.
So who is Kane? Mr. Kane? Why is it called Citizen?
That is a good question, because they never say, "It's Citizen Kane" at any point in the movie, I don't think.
I don't know.
I could be wrong. Maybe I just look it up.
Yeah. Maybe it's because when he's just like an overall good citizen, standing citizen.
Well, he does love to reference that he's an American.
Sure.
At least at the start of the movie, he does. Sure. He's like, "I'm an American."
Yeah.
Because he's able to go other places, obviously.
For the voters.
Yeah, the and future. he wants to buy love. Being a citizen means you're part of a community, and you have certain responsibilities towards the community. This is exactly what Kane thought of himself in the early part of the film. He tries to use his power and fortune to be responsible to his community and to attack the corruption of rich people and politicians. And this would, of course, be from Schmoop.com.
Schmoop, great. Very reliable.
Very reliable source. But it sounds reasonable.
But that's what he became. You know, it's tragic. You know, that self-centeredness was always there. And he turns from this, you know, supposedly self-righteous guy to just a complete jerk who, you know, is just this rich, fat. And yes, he did get fat. Billionaire. You know, the typical picture of Americans hate billionaires right now, just in general. They think that they get too involved in everything, and that I think that's true.
And I think they do get too involved in everything, but they also expect them to get involved. That's what I'm saying. The expectation from the public is that if you have a lot of money, you will be involved. Mm-hmm. But then as a billionaire, I think this has always been true, and it always will be true, likely. I don't know that there's anyone I can point to who hasn't broken this mold. If they get really involved in philanthropy, it is, I'm going to help on my own terms. No billionaire is just giving away their money and saying, here's some money, go do what you think is best with it.
No, it's...
That never happens.
Make me more powerful, or we're going to make society this way.
Yeah. Social engineering or it has terms and conditions, of course.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, and I think that's what the first Kane was trying to avoid. Maybe he was trying to. He seemed like he genuinely wanted to help at the beginning, even if he was like either double-minded or just self-infused. But yeah, I think by the end you just see this clear picture of this terrible person, the person that he would have hated from the beginning of the movie, the person that he was trying to go up against, you know. And it only takes time. He was doing the same things at the beginning of the movie than at the end of the movie, right?
Yeah.
Besides hitting women, I guess. But like, besides that, he's not really building up into worse things. He's stepping on toes since the beginning, it seems like. So I think just the time of becoming more lonely, realizing I'm not finding fulfillment, I'm not finding happiness in these things, that's what drove him to become fat. No, I'm just joking. Lonely.
He did gain quite a bit of weight, although he was, he's a stout guy ever since the beginning. But he's
yeah. But it's like, you know, they say the fat billionaires. That's the right. That's the phrase.
Because they're wealthy enough to have whatever kind of food they want, and they can have the best medical care, so it doesn't matter theoretically.
He has a doctor. Get Dr. whatever, and the nurse just stays with him overnight, like she has no other patients.
Yeah.
Personal
nurse. Yeah. How did nursing work back then?
No, I think that was just his personal nurse.
Yeah. I think because he was like, I want the nurse. Well, doctors used to do house calls too. That's kind of crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked to people who are like, oh yeah, back when I was younger, that doctor used to come over to our house. I was like, that's such a foreign concept nowadays.
Yep.
That I'm sure that happens in some instances, maybe in rural areas, but not very often.
Yeah.
Anymore.
Yeah. I mean, that'd be weird. Like, you just go inside of a hoarder's house.
Be like, well, I think I've identified one of the first problems. Like, it actually would be pretty helpful in some regards.
Yeah.
You would leave you guessing less what the situation was at home for some of the patients. Yeah.
It would be so annoying, though, like walking over Happy Meal boxes and just all these terrible things. And I don't know, like little baby dolls and like pillows.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking of collections of these things, teeth.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that's it. It's just, I don't like the word, but the word is privilege. People use that word so blatantly.
It has so many
these days.
Like meanings to it that are attached.
But the meaning that I mean in this context is, this guy can have whatever he wants, whenever he wants. And to what degree do you limit yourself when you can have things easy? Should you have them easy? I don't know, you know?
Yeah, I don't know that anybody has a good answer to these questions.
Sure.
Because most people don't get the opportunity to wrestle with these things to begin with.
And if you have the opportunity to have things extremely easy, if you could just wake up and have everything done for you, should you take that opportunity? I don't know.
Because would you argue that difficulty is the thing that defines people in their life? Like, overcoming adversity tends to be the thing that, like, how you respond to that adversity is a lot of times the growing points in your life, or it could be the backslide points in your life. Like you lose ground in terms of maturity.
Yeah. Or some people say like you are what you do.
Yeah.
And we all do terrible things. So I don't know. So, you know, at the end of the day, your actions are bringing to the world a lot of the meaning, but right. Your thoughts, you know, your thoughts are very important as well.
Yeah, true.
So,
because your thoughts will lead to the actions.
Sure. Or eventually. Your thoughts have your attitudes about things. Yeah.
Yeah. Or that, yeah, they show the underlying meaning behind your actions as sure. Well.
Sure. Yeah. So yeah, I don't know, but I'm just thinking like, if I every day I get a $10 raise, right? I start out at $10 an hour. You know, 10 days in, I'm at $110 an hour, right?
Yeah.
So now, like 30 years down the line, I'm making a ton of money, right? Ton of money. And all of a sudden, like, I just keep getting all these new things. Like, I buy a Rolls Royce, I buy a Porsche, I adopt a kid, I don't know, I just buy, like, all these cool things. Then I hire all these people, like a butler, a maid, you know, and a servants, indentured servants. Like, to what degree is it wrong? Like, what line would I have to cross for it to be a terrible thing, to be wrong, to be a sin, to be a tragedy of self-indulging, you know? I don't know.
I don't know that you can define that point. I mean, there's definitely things that you can be like, that's wrong, but those things would be wrong regardless of like how much money you had in relation to spending your money. Like if you use your money to do something that's obviously evil, mm-hmm. I guess it doesn't really matter how much money you have. Because doing, no matter how much of a percentage of the money that you're using to do that evil thing, it's still evil. So that the amount of money you have is more or less inconsequential to that situation. But it seems that within you would have to find some sort of point of conviction where you're like, oh, I have to figure out a way of like what would be the appropriate way to handle having this wealth, right?
Yeah.
Like, and I don't know that it'd be the same for every person.
Sure.
Because it seems like it would be.
But how high does it get?
I don't know.
Do you think a trillionaire should exist?
I don't know. Some of the wealth, like
should when you Jeff start Bezos talking about have
when you're talking about trillionaires, dollars? It's like a lot of the wealth is like kind of theoretical because it's wrapped up in the value of a company.
But
so can you even get rid of the wealth? Like,
yeah,
it's not like that easy to just like,
but like, when the company is structural to society, like Amazon,
yeah,
like when most packages going around the US are from Amazon, then it's real. There's value, even if it's not money, there's value there. How much money should a person, even if their value comes from a net value that's placed on their stock,
what would they do to get rid of that? Like, you sell the stock, then you get money. Then you just have a ton of money.
Well, you're trying to look at it strictly from a number standpoint. I'm saying, what like is money influence. At its root? Money at its root is more decision making, more power.
Yeah, it's influence, essentially. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, like I'm saying, like the money is just sort of it's a signifier of how much influence that the person has over their company, right?
Correct.
Like. Because, I mean, Jeff Bezos isn't the CEO of Amazon, but he's one of the highest stakeholders, so he still has a lot of decision-making influence.
And you have to think about it. Like, that's why the economy is important. It is an important thing because you have, like, this paper that would have no value unless other people valued it. You know, it's a social contract when you go to buy something. It's something that people accept because they need goods. Because I can't be a farmer, a hunter, and
I can't live in Minecraft, essentially.
Sure, yeah. You can't do everything all at once, so we have to specialize. You know, we're really good at that. So if I want to specialize in one, you know, you have these doctors that specialize in one square inch of the heart, and that's like their specialty, and they make $1 million a year. You know,
and they're the only doctor that does that. They took that square inch of the heart.
Or like, I specialize in the tip of the nose.
There's so much we haven't learned about it yet. You wouldn't believe.
Yeah. So it's just like, And that's what it is. It's just a social contract. So at the end of the day, that's why it's important, because people accept it's important. And once if anything were to collapse, it's because everybody says it collapses. That's stocks. That's trading. That's everything. That's bonds. But
we see that every day with stocks.
You also have to understand it's the government as well, because you have the Fed controlling all of these different interest rates, trying to control, you know, just fight back inflation, fight
the
against
SEC.
Yeah. But really, you know, the Fed is like the one setting these interest rates. So, you do have some influence there. But at the end of the day, like, the value from money comes from that. So then you think of Citizen Kane. You think of Charles Foster Kane. What does he have the most? He has all of these things. He has a mansion full of all of these items and all of these statues. Was it statues he collected?
Yeah, statues.
I didn't even see a lot of statues. I was trying to look around.
Just like artifacts. There's like the Statue of Venus, like those sorts of
things. He had that? I wasn't looking.
He was like, I can't believe how much you paid for a statue with no head.
Oh, that's what he was talking about.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's a good catch. But so he has all of these things. But for him, he wasn't adding power. He already had all the power he wanted, because he couldn't get any more because he wasn't elected. But he's just spending this money on stuff that he's just self-indulging. I think for sure he crossed the line. You can say that.
Oh, yeah. Because his motive, maybe it's about your motive. Like, maybe your motive with which, maybe it's not about having, although certainly hoarding all of the wealth that wouldn't seem to do that much good. And I don't even know how you actually hoard wealth, because at some point it'll lose its value if you're just hoarding it. But you're right. He got extremely self-indulgent, and it was very clear. I mean, the last line with his wife, where he tries to get her to come back by saying, it'll change, you can't do this to me. And then she realizes she's not being tricked by him anymore. She's not letting his power like lord over her anymore, because she realizes like, okay, this guy is just really self-centered. He says that things are going to change, but they're not, because I can tell by the way that he is talking to me right now that he's still looking out for his self-interest.
Like, he couldn't just say one other line. He almost had her.
Yeah.
He couldn't just say like, please, and then end it there.
And honestly, he maybe could have said something that was out of character for him, that would have been like where he apologized very sincerely, and she might have been like, oh, this is actually something that he's changing. But he didn't really do that.
It seemed like she was waiting for something.
Yeah.
Like, say the right words and I'll stay, maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, he did not say the right words. And I thought that when he said that, I was like, that's a stupid thing to say. And then she like acknowledged it, and I was like surprised that she acknowledged it. But you know, you have this, it is sad, because I think we can all kind of relate to this guy. Like, he's searching for all these, you know, he's searching for something, you know, he doesn't even know what he's searching for, because what he lost, he can't get back. It's his mom, his childhood. He's never seen her since. So you can see how that affected him.
Extremely like sterile kind of environment that it was like about gaining wealth the whole time.
Well, now, did you see where he lived? It was like Antarctica. It was like just a blizzard. He's out in the snow, and there's one snowman, and there's like a hut.
I was talking about when he got to Chicago, but you're right. Where he would have grown up wasn't exactly stellar either.
Yeah, you're right. Where he did grow up. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Just following, what was the guy's name again?
Thatcher,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it is cool. You can see the influences. So I think the way that the direction that Orson Welles took with this film, looking at other people describing him, not actually meeting the character himself, really did help. Because then the character is not so interested in our perspective, that you can see the character's life pan out over decades just because of this, the storytelling.
And I think then the character also can't win you over, because there's no denying that Charles Foster Kane is a very charismatic person, and a lot of people who gain influence are charismatic people. They're good at saying things in the right way in the right situations in order to gain influence over people. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, you realize that.
Do you think Sam Bankman-Fried is charismatic?
No, I don't think he's charismatic at all.
Sorry,
I've never seen him talk.
Go ahead.
But
because he's not.
But he did gain influence with money, though.
Yeah,
fake money. But yeah, still. But charismatic people end up rising to the top in a lot of situations. I mean, politicians, you have to be able to give speeches. You have to be able to win people over with the way that you talk. So, of course, naturally, you have to be charismatic. But charisma doesn't yield conviction or good morals or anything like that. It's just charisma on its own. It could you could be charismatic and have those things, but it doesn't prove that you have any of those things. And so over time, is when you're in a relationship with a person, is how you'll end up. They'll either prove to you that they are who they say they are, or they'll prove to you that they're not. And you'll realize that they're not going to be everything that they, because nobody's perfect. Like, they're going to like claim things, and then you're going to realize, oh, they're not actually that good. Yep. There's always a disappointment.
It only took everybody. 3 dinners with his first wife.
Yeah.
I'm exactly. Just joking. It was obviously over time, but
yeah, but it shows over time how relationships can deteriorate because there was expectations by each side and they weren't correct, or one of them is growing in a negative direction, or one of them is maturing in a positive direction and the other one's not, or so many other different types of circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But
that's true.
If you have expectations that are, that somebody's going to like complete your life and be able to provide everything that you need, you're just going to always be disappointed because there's no human who will ever do that, no matter how charismatic they are or how much wealth they have or any number of things.
Not even Kanye or Trump or
no
Joe Biden or
definitely not any of those people.
Dang it.
Or
not any of those people.
Ron DeSantis.
Ron DeSantis.
Or Nancy Pelosi or AOC.
No. I don't think anybody thought that.
I'm just trying to give both sides of the audience a chance
whatever
to say.
You want. You can say whatever you want.
Yeah, I'm just saying that if you hold on to any of those people, they're all going to disappoint you. That's sure. My point to the audience.
Yeah, that's a good. That's
some,
a good point.
Some may prove to disappoint less than others, but they're all going to be disappointing to an extent.
True. Sorry, I'm receiving a call. I'm pretty popular these days.
Yeah, Zach, a very charismatic person.
I am a very charismatic person. I am just working the people all day long.
Yeah.
Yep.
All day
busting
long.
Busting my campaign. But yeah, I think 4.5 out of 5. I think after this movie, I was thinking 4 out of 5 stars. I really was. And I'm sorry for all those cinephiles out there that just like to tag along and bandwagon.
I okay, go ahead.
No, you can't. I'm not talking about you at all. I'm saying those people out there that watch this movie and are like, oh, 5 out of 5 just because I want it to be.
Yeah.
I was thinking 4, but I'm thinking after this conversation, since I can relate to this man pretty well, probably 4.5 out of 5.
I just want to briefly go over, so you know who Sight and Sound is, the British Film Institute?
Go ahead, yeah.
They did a top 10, well, every 10 years they do a top 10 list. And they
of all time?
Of all time.
Okay.
And they interview critics and directors.
Mm.
And Citizen Kane made the list in both polls. But I was just going to read like what the top 10 from the critics and directors are,
mm-hmm.
so that you have like a
go for
like
it.
What
go,
people
go.
Think are the best movies. So number 10 is from the critics list. This is the critics list now. Singing in the Rain.
Definitely not.
And then number 9 is Man with a Movie Camera, which I've never heard of, but it was made in the USSR in 1929. So that's probably why I've never heard of it. Number 8, you're going to be familiar with this one. 2001's Mulholland Drive.
Oh, yeah.
Made the list for the first time. Then Beau Travail by Claire Denis, 1998 French movie. And then number 6 was 2001 A Space Odyssey. Number 5 was In the Mood for Love, one of my favorites, so I appreciate that it made the list. Number 4 is Tokyo Story, which I believe was previously the number 1 before this iteration of the list. Number 3 was Citizen Kane. Number 3, best
only
movie overall.
Only 3.
Number 2, Vertigo.
Oh my goodness, really?
Yeah. And number 1, this movie was new to the list and also is now number 1, so I don't know
exactly
what happened. It's not Shape of Water. It's
Moonlight.
Jean Delman, 23, Quai du Commerce, 1080 Bruxelles.
We just lost all of our French listeners.
And this is a Belgian. This is Belgium/France. It was a completely terrible pronunciation. I'm gonna have to look into this movie. This was directed by Chantal Ackerman in 1975. Somehow went from not being on the list at all to being number 1. So
maybe the guy who made the list died. And then his, like,
it's
protege
people
came
voting
up.
Though, so it must have just got a big push in the voting sphere because okay. It also made the Tokyo Story might have been number 1 in the.
Is Vertigo really up there?
Yeah, Vertigo.
Do people
two.
Like it like as all of all time?
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. I Psycho is obviously the most well known, I think, mm-hmm. but Vertigo is also very well known. The and then quickly the director's list is Persona by Ingmar Bergman, In the Mood for Love, Wong Kar Wai. Close Up, Mirror by Andrei Tarkovsky. 8.5, Fellini, another one of my favorites. Vertigo, again, Hitchcock. Tokyo Story, that Belgian movie, got tied for number 4. Then The Godfather made the director's list at 3rd. So it's interesting, it didn't make the critics list, but it made the director's list. Number 2, Citizen Kane. And then number 1, 2001, A Space Odyssey. So it's like, there's a fair amount of overlap, but you can maybe start to see like what critics feel is important and what directors feel is important. Because I feel like 2001, A Space Odyssey, I've never seen it. I will watch it this year. It's on my list for movies to definitely watch this year. But it's known for its like incredible cinematography and like directing and all of that. So directors may prioritize that. But I do think it's interesting that this, you know, you go into a movie that's this like, oh my gosh, like sometimes you think you're going to get let down. I don't feel like I got let down by this movie.
Yeah, I don't know what I was expecting.
Honestly not expecting anything. I knew very little about the movie.
I thought it was going to be like a journalist piece, kind of like a, yeah, I don't know. I thought it'd be more journalism stuff, but the journalist was barely in it, which was all right. It was good. I didn't know it would be like a following a story of a guy's life.
Yeah, they call it like a quasi autobiography because it's an autobiography about a fictional person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why they call it autobiography because it's not really written by the guy who made it, but quasi biography maybe.
Yeah, no, but I'm glad it's up there. Now we can say we saw it. As we make our way through the best films of all time, then we can finally say we saw it. And then we have to watch blah, 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 whatever the number one was from the French guy.
Yeah. apparently A.O. Scott had a strong reaction to that movie being number one.
What did he say? Tell us.
I don't know.
A.O. Scott's our favorite.
A.O. Scott's been around since the inception of the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
He's I made fun of him, guy. But he's actually a well-known critic.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. Was it Roger Ebert?
Yeah.
I didn't know that he had jaw cancer, like cancer in his jaw.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what he passed away from, I believe.
He's dead? I didn't know he's dead.
Yeah, you didn't know he's dead. He's been dead for a little bit.
But he,
because they still have a website, so I think it's a little.
They
confusing.
Took off his. They removed his jaw in like 2006.
Really? Yeah, oh, so there was a while
that he was without his jaw. But maybe he had another cancer or it came, I don't know, it came back, I don't know. But yeah, his voice box was severed, I think.
A.O. Scott was in favor of it, as he said it was a welcome jolt to the critical system.
That's all he said?
I'm sure
Are you kidding me, Scott? That's it.
Yet the summary boils down to 3 hours of quiet.
Is he's talking about the French movie?
Yeah.
It's 3 hours?
I think it might be 3 hours, and it might be like a very like deliberate watch. Like, you're not going to see a lot of stuff happen.
Okay. Like paint drying.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll have to look more into that movie.
Okay. I mean, you can. I'll probably sit that one out.
Well, I didn't say I was going to watch it. Read a couple articles maybe about it.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Ben, what do you think? So still 5 out of 5 even after the conversation?
Yeah. I think it's come to the time I need to go back and reevaluate my 5 out of 5s. There's like two different ways I feel like movies end up as 5 out of 5s for me. One is like very personal. Like Donnie Darko, I don't think is like a 5 out of... Like it should never end up on like a top 10 critics poll or anything like that. Because it's just not like... It's a intriguing movie, and it's perhaps a very sentimental movie, but it's in no way like a boundary pushing.
For well, sure,
it might be boundary pushing in a few senses,
but not of the films of all time.
Not to be considered in the greatest films of all time. But I don't think that you should not acknowledge that you really like something just because you don't think it's like objectively the greatest thing of all time. Because I think you'll be very disappointed with. Like, or you're not revealing your true feelings towards something.
Whatever you want to say.
It's kind of meaningless. And
I think it's good because I think the more movies you watch, the more your palate changes, and you start to understand things that you maybe didn't understand before. You know, see the cool things that some movies have and some movies don't, and then you start to see the art in a lot of the older movies and how other movies fall off. Like they use those ideas in the future movies and stuff like that. So it's kind of cool to see that. But at the end of the day, you know, you have your favorites and you have the ones that you think are really, really well made, and you kind of got to mix those as your 5 out of 5s.
Yeah, so. I agree. There's just some movies that are just going to mean more to you. Also, some movies are real can re- have a really compelling, like, when you watch them initially, it, like, there's something that that really, like, sticks with you. But then as you think about it, it might not be, it might kind of go fade. But some movies are the opposite, where the initial time you viewed it, you were like, oh, this is...
You gotta rank it like a day about after. It. You gotta let your emotions fade away. It's like
and
a
then,
drug.
And then some emotions build. Like, there's been movies that I'm like, a couple months later, I'm like, man, I would really love to watch that movie again. Like, I didn't think about like it what? As much the first time. I'm trying to think of an example of a movie that was like that for me.
I don't think I've ever had that.
You've never had that?
No.
Because I think some movies I just don't quite latch onto right away. And then pretty soon.
I hope I have that. It sounds nice. I don't think I've ever wanted to rewatch a film.
I'm sure. There's definitely been movies. Oh, I think Enemy was one.
Okay.
That was like
Gyllenhaal.
I think there's some weird stuff in it, but like I was like, this is very strange. It's usually movies that are more like bizarre, I guess, because then you have some time to let it settle. But maybe you also sometimes what happens is you remember the good parts about the movie and kind of forget a part about the parts you didn't like, and then you go back and watch the movie. You're like, man, and then you're kind of disappointed because you're sure. like, oh, this is. I only was remembering these parts, and I wasn't remembering these parts.
That's most of the movies I rewatch. That's yeah. why I don't like to rewatch.
Oh, I see. Yeah. What you're saying. Yeah. But I think, like, a movie that I watched last year that was, like, immediately I was like, that's incredible was Black Swan. Oh. Like, it was just, like, I was so, like, it was the way that Aronofsky is, he draws you in with it, like, this character is so obsessed with one thing, and it's so painful, and you have to go on that journey with the character, and it's so tragic at the end when ultimately that obsession like is their demise, which I feel like is like every one of his movies. I haven't even seen most of his movies. I just know that that's what probably most of his movies end in, is that the obsession or addiction or whatever leads to the character's demise.
Yeah.
So that was one that was like, but it was just so the drifting back and forth between reality and fiction, it was just all like building up. And
have you rewatched it?
I have not rewatched it. Okay. Though. If I rewatch it, it might not be 5 stars. That's okay. What I'm saying though.
Okay, like, so you're guarding movies, yourself from that.
Yeah.
Oh.
So some movies, like I watched it initially, I'd be like, it's 5 stars. But I'm like, if I went back and rewatched this movie, it might not be 5 stars.
Yeah, but then you're just lying to yourself.
Kind of, but I can't really honestly say that it's not 5 stars.
But you're living in an emotion that is just yours.
Because it's the same thing with
Drugstore. It's not what Darren wanted.
With Drugstore Cowboy.
Well, like, sure, yeah.
That movie, I don't even really remember half of what happened in that movie, but I still have it listed as a 5 out of 5. Because at the time that I watched it, I was like, that was incredible.
Gotcha, okay.
So I don't think you'll ever be able to like fully...
I think it takes rewatching every movie 1 or 2 times
yep.
to solidify those things.
Yep. That, yeah, to really know, yeah.
I follow this guy in Letterboxd. I follow this guy. I don't know. I'm not going to say his username, but he literally watches like 8 movies a day. He just watches movies. That's all he does.
And you ever wonder that those people are like lying?
No, I don't think this guy is. Like,
is he the guy who's logged like 30,000 movies?
No, it's too specific. Not like 30, but like he watched 1,000 movies last year. So like he took a couple days off, but he watched at least 3 movies a day, you know?
Yeah.
1,500 something. And that's, to me, that's like, man, like, go find out something else to do.
I think there needs to be a Darren Aronofsky movie made about that guy.
Sure, yeah. And then his demise is he's so fat.
That seems like an obsession. You do wonder about those people. There is a guy I've seen on Letterboxd who has 30,000 movies logged in his life.
Gosh, how old is he?
I mean, first of all, you wonder, is that guy just lying? But and he could be. You'll never know. But if he's not lying, you're like, this guy does not work a job. And has he ever worked a job?
He doesn't need to. He's got an inheritance.
He's either has to have an inheritance or somebody who's just paying for his expenses.
Or he's like a film writer, film critique online.
I mean, he could be a film critic, but
critique.
As a film critic, you have to set aside time in your day to write stuff. You can't just watch movies all day.
Right as you watch.
I guess so. I guess, yeah, I don't know how passive he's watching these movies, too. Yeah. Some people work from home, just have the movie on in the background all day.
Or you can work from home and just have your computer open, install a program that moves your mouse around so your computer tracking is on.
Oh, like Office Space, where there's people who are literally just doing nothing.
Yeah.
And that actually exists in the corporate world. And
that exists especially during COVID, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm going to do one day.
Yeah, hopefully.
Prescribing medications.
I mean, that is the American dream.
That's a joke.
Yeah, I know.
I have to say that.
The American dream is that you eventually work your way up to a position where you don't have to do anything anymore and you can still make a lot of money.
Yeah. I can't wait. I can't wait. I can't wait to retire when I'm 45 and just die.
And then go to Florida. I mean, but people who retire die earlier.
I'm not going to Florida to pick up seashells.
It's quality over quantity, right? Quality of life over your quantity.
That's why I'm dying when I'm 45. I'm not going to fart and not know.
Because they do say, they're like, if you retire early, you die early. But then if you had 20 more years where you're working, like,
this is what I'm going to do.
70 hours
a week.
I'm
going to retire when I'm 35, save up all this money, then start a family after I retire.
That makes no sense with your current career trajectory.
I'm doing the opposite.
But do that.
I'm doing the opposite.
That'd be funny. It's like, okay, I'm retired, now I can start a family.
Yeah,
I'm like, have all this wealth set aside, so now they'll never have to worry about anything.
Then your kids will take
care
of
you. I can be with my kids at all times. Mm-hmm. It might not be even that bad of an idea.
Or I could plant the seeds early, have the wife raise them for a few years, and then, no, that's terrible. These are all stupid plans.
Yeah, but
4.5 out of 5 for me. I think it was pretty stellar. I don't know what I would have thought. I just don't know what I was expecting.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Expectations can be a tricky thing with movies. Because sometimes expectations, I think it is true that expectations can influence your final verdict on a movie. Like you sometimes want to believe that.
People would have hated No Way Home if the other two Spider-Men were in it.
Yeah.
That's what
that movie has
does.
Tanked a lot. I need to change my Letterboxd rating on it, honestly.
Would you give it a 5?
No. I'd probably give it like a 4, though, which
you
I think is
4?
Too high.
I have a 3.
Yeah. I think it should be a 3 is probably more
That's
fair.
That's mine. Yeah.
Like, because it's easy to get caught in the emotional highs of things and then not look at them as objectively.
I think I'm just different. I think I naturally do less because maybe I either temper my emotions or I just don't have them, or I know in the moment, like, I think it's 4.5, so I'm going to give it a 3.
You know how to assess your own things.
Maybe. Or
most of the time,
I'm just pessimist.
Yeah, I think, it is. I think for me, it is definitely a temptation to become like kind of like attached to a certain movie because you start to be like, I mean, Letterboxd does this. This is one of the criticisms people have of Letterboxd, but I think it's great, actually. People think that like you start to pick movies in a way that like, you're like rating movies high that you think will make people stick out. It's like, oh, they like that movie. Oh, wow, that's very interesting. Or like, wow, he gave Woman Under under the Influence 4.5 out of 5. He must be a very
woke man.
Not woke. a very well studied person to be able to understand that film and give it a 4.5 out of 5.
It's just snobs. Anything like that is snobbery. Anything.
But I think snobbery is awesome.
No.
That's my take.
What is wrong with you?
No, it's cool.
Why?
It's fun.
No, it's not.
Being a snob is fun.
No, it's not.
It is. And it's not being a snob in a way that's like, I'm better than other people because I know
I'm
not.
Well, that's what snob is. What are you talking about?
Okay. I just think it's fun to write things in a like a pretentious but semi-ironic way.
Yeah, I'm
like,
not,
so
I'm
that
never
way,
gonna do that
it's
ever.
Like a self-aware snob. Like, I'm being a snob, but I'm also aware that it's ridiculous some of the things that I say.
Okay.
Right? Like, it's
then
the same thing with music.
Yourself.
Like, when we were listening to that Harsh Noise band, if you were to be like, oh, this is the greatest band of all time,
it's not.
Everyone would know that you're being a pretentious snob and that you're trying to be.
I think
but it's
the
kind
back
of fun
of
to
my
pretend
brain,
to play that role sometimes.
No, it's, I disagree.
I think it is.
No, the back part of my brain was like, I could definitely actually get into this, but I told you, I'm not going to let myself get into it. It's all about control. That's what I think. I don't think I'm never going to write something like, oh, this was a preposterous movie with a subpar plot and blah, 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 blah. I write,
but
when
somebody
I write things,
has to, you have to write those sort of things.
No, I write what I mean. I write what I think. I'm not going to try to, I'm not going to spend more than 5 minutes writing something.
Yeah. I mean, that's true.
One, I don't have the time. Two, I don't want to.
Yeah.
But you can. Then I'm not saying you shouldn't. I just think
I just think that I find more fun in the snob culture than other people do. And maybe it's because if somebody came up to me and was like, oh, I can't believe that you think Inglourious Basterds is a 5 out of 5 or that any Quentin Tarantino movie is higher than 3.5 out of 5 or whatever. Because I realized that like none of that stuff like actually matters like to my actual life. Like what I think of a Quentin Tarantino movie isn't going to like ultimately matter all that much. So it's just all it should just all be fun. The minute that your like emotional being is like being defined by how other people are like reacting to what you put out on Letterboxd or any other social media thing, unless it's something that has like actual merit to concern, where somebody's saying like, I'm concerned about like how you're acting in a certain way, like, okay, that might
Ben,
be
I'm
fair.
Concerned about how you're acting in a certain way.
No, but I just mean like these opinion-based things. Like people do, I mean, people, I've heard of people who have like on Letterboxd, they've started to like develop these like OCD things around the app. It's hard to believe, but it happens. And they have to like everyone's reviews so that everyone likes their reviews. And it gets, and that's how all social media works. It's just a microcosm mm-hmm. of a particular one.
Sure.
So
it's for the sickest of those.
Yeah, but I'm saying that I'm better than those people. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not.
I'm concerned about the way that you are acting.
I'm not better than those people.
Your emotional well-being is being defined. No, I'm just joking. I'm joking, but I
try to be aware that you can't.
Sure,
that,
whatever, this, whatever.
That consuming art should in no way define who you are, because that would just be silly, first of all. It'd yeah, be silly for
you're
that
right,
to be.
I agree.
And then secondly, even if it wasn't silly, it would be, you would always end up being disappointed, just like Charles Foster Kane.
Yeah, you're definitely right.
But I do think that it can be a temptation for me to do that, to like try to make it part of like me more than it should be. So that's why I'm saying this right now. It's a confession and a self-aware kind of tangent.
All right, with that.
And now I made the podcast all about myself. See what I did there? Not about Zach at all.
No, that's all right. I don't want it about me. Great. So anyway, it was a good one. Thank you for saying we should watch this one.
Yeah,
this is good. In your list.
Yeah, this is on my list. So we checked off. I think this is the third movie of the 25.
What was the second? Stranger Than Paradise was on.
No, I didn't. Stranger Than Paradise was not on it technically.
Oh.
But I wanted to watch a movie that was an hour and a half. So
that's right. That's right. I forgot.
Because I was lazy. I don't know. That was a good movie though.
Yeah.
I think. I'm trying to. Oh, that's not the right list. Dang it. There's too many lists. I'm in the middle of El Camino right now. So that's going to be on the list.
I just finished season 3 of Better Call Saul.
Really?
Yeah. I'm liking it as much.
You're liking it as much. Mm-hmm. I need to get into it then. Mm-hmm. But I also don't, because I don't have time.
Yeah.
That's great. So, yeah, so this is the third one of 25. And Zach also has 25. Maybe at some point we'll talk about our lists.
Maybe. We'll see.
But maybe. We'll see how that happens.
I'm not going to make any commitments.
All right. Just a shout out, Hedman Anglin Agency.
Yep.
Because we didn't shout them out in the middle. If you are concerned about any insurance-related things.
Such as statues or
and
banners.
Why did I close where the phone number is? And why do I not have it memorized?
It's
let's see if other Zach can get it.
Something 7300 604.
It's 486-7300.
That's right.
614-486-7300. And tell them Ben and Zach sent you. Hedman Anglin Agency, auto, home,
business.
And business. And with that, we'll close the vault.
Yep. World War II.